Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all, Canada's most irreverent talk show here, The Andrew Lawton Show on True North on this Monday, April 8th, 2024. I will just warn you right up front because I'm worried that there will be some big calamitous thing that takes place Monday morning and this show will be dated. This is the exception to the rule. This show is actually pre-recorded. I am on my way right now. I'm in Ottawa. I had to tend to something that I will give you an update on tomorrow. But tomorrow for you, not tomorrow for me. See, this is why we don't pre-tape. It just gets so confusing. But we are pre-taping the show today, and I'll tell you all about it later this week. But I did want to follow up on a discussion we had on a previous episode that was really interesting. And it was about Saskatchewan and what that province is doing to stand up for the rights of law-abiding gun owners. I spoke about this in broad strokes and kind of the national picture with Rod Giltaka from the Canadian Coalition for Firearm Rights. But I thought there was enough going on there with the Saskatchewan government expanding the firearms office there and really taking advantage of some of the tools it has in its toolkit as a province to really give the federal government a run for its money, money that the federal government is spending a lot of to do very little, in fact, nothing that will enhance or uphold public safety. So with that, I wanted to welcome into the show Murray Cowan, who is the new Chief Firearms Officer of Saskatchewan, and Robert Freeberg, who had the role up until just a couple of weeks back and has now taken on a new position as the Firearms Commissioner of Saskatchewan. Murray, Robert, good to talk to you both. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Andrew. Really glad to be here.
Thanks for having us on your program.
So let me just first start with you, Murray, in terms of understanding this for people in the country who aren't firearms owners or even who are but haven't navigated the system as much. What is your role as you envision it? What is this supposed to be?
Sure. It's and as you know, Andrew, it's a brand new role. So I'm still getting comfortable and learning the ins and outs of what of everything I'll actually be doing. But primarily, I'm taking some of the workload off of Bob here, and we talked about this quite a bit as I came into the organization. But he was basically wearing two hats, and I couldn't believe how hard he was working to develop this program and to develop the firearms office here in Saskatchewan. So basically, what I'm going to be looking at in general is taking over the operational side and kind of providing oversight to the firearms program, and looking after the new ballistics lab that we're developing. Once it's up and running, and just providing general oversight. So and Bob can probably explain a little more in detail because he's got a better understanding about some of it, but. There's different branches of our firearms office now, and which will focus more for me on the operational side.
Yeah, and I will go to you, Bob, because you obviously had this role previously, and now you're shifting in as part of this expansion to the commissioner role, which is one that's certainly not as familiar to me. What's that, and how do you fit into this landscape now?
Well, that's a great question, and the reason the commissioner role came about for a couple of reasons, Andrew, is that we started off just taking over the duties of a chief firearms office, which was called opting in, which is a term that's used across Canada with provinces that decide that they want to appoint their own CFO to administer the firearms program under direction from CFP. We started off in that direction back when they hired me in August of 2020. I was appointed as the CFO in September of 2021. But what we've discovered in getting into the role around firearms, that there was a lot more needed. Now, of course, there's advocacy, there's education, but there was also a need from our law enforcement partners to establish, for example, a ballistics lab, also work within a framework of provincial regulations. And the provincial regulations really are mirroring some of the federal regulations or legislation, I should really say properly. But what we've done is for the administrative expense, errors like someone forgetting to renew their PAL or not recognizing that their firearm is now prohibited because they haven't yet sent any documentation. We've created some offenses out of the province that allows us to deal with those outside of laying a criminal conviction. So with that, we've developed a SAS firearms office. And under that, we've developed the pillars like the ballistics lab, Chief Firearms Officer's Lab, our client services unit, and of course our lawyers that work within our legal unit. So when we did that, and we came up with the Saskatchewan Firearms Act back in April of last year, they put into place a role of a commissioner, because really a CFO traditionally isn't dealing with a lot of those issues. So what we've done now with this, creating a separate ministry or secretariat, as it's defined under legal provincial legislation, what we've done is now they've assigned me as the commissioner. So my duties is to look from a top-down approach as to what we can do around advocacy, what we can do around supporting the police agencies, what we can do around our legal framework with assisting law enforcement in a number of ways. And of course, the main thing is getting out and spending time with our stakeholders. So this new division of power, division of authority, gives me a bit more flexibility to do that. And we can put some of the operational work onto Murray's desk to look after.
Well, when you talk about engaging with stakeholders, that's so key. I mean, I'm a firearms owner. I know there are a lot of gun owners that watch and listen to this show. And they feel that certainly at the federal level, they're the ones that are left dealing with the consequences of regulations and legislation, but they don't actually have any real role in advising the government or any meaningful role in that. And I know that, you know, Murray, you're a career police officer, you were a police chief, you understand this, that you've got this set of laws that, gun owners are the only ones following and obeying, that are not doing anything about the people that are being arrested in downtown Toronto with an illegal handgun.
Sure, Andrew, 100%. Our goal here, and my goal, is certainly to focus on the public safety aspect of it. But my role is also to support legal and lawful, law-abiding gun owners across the country. And I may sound like a broken record when I say that, but lots of folks, and the vast majority of gun owners in this country are licensed, vetted, and legal and law-abiding. And I see it as they're not the problem primarily, but it's the illegal guns, it's the criminals, and the folks that aren't going to follow the laws regardless. And that's part of our work here at the firearms office as well, is to focus on the criminal side of it, and work with our policing partners, as Bob already alluded to.
Well, you mentioned earlier the ballistics lab. I don't know which of you is best positioned to speak to this, but I actually find this to be tremendously important, because I've had trouble as a journalist getting really solid data on where the guns that are used in crime have come from. There seems to be this patchwork across the country. You get some statistics from CBSA and American border officials. You get some from some local police officers. Most of it tends to support this idea that the guns used in crime are by and large smuggled in across the border. But tracing the origins of guns used in crime, is that not a big part of what this lab will be able to do?
Yeah, and I'll speak to that question, because I've been involved on that. We've now put an exec director on who comes from the RCMP and comes with a vast experience as an ident person in running the DNA repository in the province and so forth. But one of the goals of the program is to, of course, trace firearms, get the serial numbers off of firearms that have been obliterated using various scientific techniques, so we can find out where they're coming from. And to your point, Andrew, I mean, a lot of these firearms, are not coming from lawful gun owners. They're locking them up and have security systems in their house. Now, granted, there is long guns that have been getting stolen and chopped down and made into modified prohibited firearms. And we've been doing a big education program around that in Saskatchewan, with billboards and advertising and radio saying, secure firearms, safe for communities. We've also spending a lot of time in education, going out to gun shows and home shows and other people, reiterating the message that as responsible gun owners, we need to remain vigilant in locking up our firearms. But getting back to the lab question, obviously, yes, the tracing's a big deal. Looking at the brass casings and seeing if they can be tied to a firearm. So you have a crime scene where there's casings, you're entering that into a database, you're finding a gun on the, from a criminal, maybe on a roadside stop or some other arrest, and now you're able to tie that firearm back to that incident, and it gives you a lot more information as to where it came from, how it was tied to a crime. It maybe come from Toronto. It could have come from Vancouver. It might have come from Alberta. It might have come from somebody down the street. So, you know, the federal government closed the provincial lab in Saskatchewan many years ago, and our police partners are saying it could take a year or two to get any information back by sending the guns to RCMP labs. So we're excited about having our own facility. We'll, of course, work in partnership with those other labs. But again, having our own facility again here in Saskatchewan is key. And I want to say that I'm very impressed with the provincial government because they're funding our program, $12.5 million this year, 100% coming from the provincial government. Not a dime is coming from the federal government. And yet we continue to hear that they're supporting, you know, illegal use of firearms. And yet we're spending $42 million on a gun buyback that hasn't confiscated a single firearm. Why are we putting some of that money across Canada into the type of initiatives that we're doing here in Saskatchewan?
Well, since you bring up the buyback, I'll ask you, Murray, because the Saskatchewan government has said that, they've basically put in legislation that will make it very difficult for any agent of the federal government to come in and start collecting the, I don't even like using the term buyback, because the back implies it was the government's in the first place. But nevertheless, semantics aside, I assume that participating in this is not at all a part of your mandate.
Well, we've got the, we've introduced the Saskatchewan Firearms Act, which of course is provincial legislation. And there is legislation in that document that speaks specifically to the buyback program. And you're correct. We have gatekeepers in place that will, so that we can control who's actually collecting these guns, assuming this was to move forward, and to be able to control in some respects the dollar value of these firearms. Some of these firearms are worth a significant amount of money. Understanding and knowing firearms the way I do, we want to ensure that things aren't undervalued. Some firearms are worth over $10,000, we want to make sure there's fair compensation that way.
Let me ask either or both of you here about the road forward from now, because you've obviously got a lot of the regulations are federal, and certainly when it comes to classification of guns that are prohibited overnight, that's done by the federal government, handguns as well. This has been federal government. How much latitude do provinces have to really, basically, where is the space where provinces really have that latitude they need to serve gun owners and serve public safety?
Well, I'll speak to that. Obviously, the federal legislation is federal law, and we're here to enforce that. But again, with the Firearms Act, for example, I'll use a good example. We have someone, say, in rural Saskatchewan that has a Mini 14. They've been using it to hunt predators for years. They don't even know that it's on the list. They've never been sent a letter because no one knows they own it because it's not registered. And they go out and use it as the tool that they've intended to, and all of a sudden now they're getting a roadside check, and they're saying that they're getting charged with having a prohibited firearm, which could end up 5 years in prison. So in those circumstances, the police have the ability to charge under the Provincial Act, and we can look at that and say, well, that was an administrative error versus going to have to turn the firearm in because it is part of the prohib list. But same token,
and that goes, just to interject, that goes back to what you were talking about earlier of adding this sort of provincial category of offense that deals with some of these things.
Yes, because obviously if somebody's doing a criminal offense and, creating a public safety risk, we're going to use all the federal laws, and our lawyers and our officer know them very well, and we're going to throw the book at these people, so to speak, make sure that we're getting a prosecution and it's not, that charge isn't getting washed out for another charge. So again, if you're using a gun illegally in Saskatchewan with what we're doing with the lab and what we're doing with our own lawyers and our firearms office, we're going to be getting pretty aggressive with that. But at the same token, if someone doesn't know that their license expired or they didn't know that the firearm that they owned for 20 years is now on a prohibition list, and we want to work with those folks with some sort of alternative measure. So to your point, we have to use the federal laws, but I'm very similar to driving while impaired. There's the ability to have the 0.08 criminal code legislation, but as there's many provinces like BC and so forth that have put alternate measures in to curb drinking and driving without having people go to jail. So we're really using the same methodology around the firearms.
No, you're very right. I mean, look, I live and breathe news, so I follow this stuff very closely. I believe I got a letter at one point notifying me of one of the changes to firearms that I own, but I know people that didn't receive that letter. And, you know, theoretically, if they don't follow the ins and outs of this stuff, I see that scenario you described as being quite commonplace. And you know, one of the things that's so interesting here is that you have in almost every case that I'm aware of every gun owner I know, people that are very diligent and want to protect the law, people that kind of panic. Like, I remember when I got my training done and, you know, they told me about the importance of taking a direct route. I'm like, I can't even stop for gas if I'm on the way from my range to my house with a handgun. Like, I was just that panicked about just making sure I was doing everything right. And there does seem to be in a lot of the approach that we see, certainly for the federal government, assuming the worst. And you know, to go back to you, Murray, with being in policing, like that the guy who did what Bob just described, treating them the same way as someone who has a firearm for illegal purposes.
Well, that's right. And you know, Andrew, like law-abiding people in this country, let alone the province, are like they're afraid. Like they want to follow the law, as you mentioned, and they want to they don't want to get into trouble. And in a lot of cases, they're not understanding it either. And so they're worried, they're scared, and they're not really sure what to do a lot of times. And I know our office here receives calls with a lot of questions in relation to that, because they're really not sure. And it's sad in a way, because as I mentioned before, our criminals and those who don't follow the law, they don't care about any of that.
Yeah, well, very well said. I'm glad to see two people in these roles that know the rules and regulations in and out, but also understand, I think, the function of this. And it's good to know that if you're a gun owner in Saskatchewan, you've got an ally. And as an Ontarian, I can say to you both, I'm quite jealous. So thank you very much to both of you. Murray Cowan, Chief Firearms Officer of Saskatchewan, and Robert Freeburg, Firearms Commissioner of Saskatchewan. Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate the time.
Thanks, Andrew. Appreciate your interest.
Well, we now go from Saskatchewan, one province west. It is Monday, and it would not be a Monday without our good friend Chris Sims, Alberta Director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. Chris, I know I'm going to see you in like 2 days in person, so we're doubling up on the Sims quota this week, but it's the only thing that's supply managed on the Andrew Lawton Show is the quota of Sims, and you can never have enough is my view. But good to have you on. Thanks for coming on today.
Thanks for having me on. And I need to thank you personally for that country song. That was really kind of you. It got
the voice of Alberta. Yeah. People have been like requesting it. I had someone say, is it on iTunes? So we could have been making money off this. I had no idea.
Just imagine. Yeah. Friends and family have reached out saying, really? So it was really nice. So thank you for that. It's good to be here.
I love it. Well, we've been talking about how you've not been letting the Alberta government off the hook on the gas tax going up. It's just not what taxpayers need. A little bit of good news on the Alberta taxpayer horizon, though. The MLAs have done the right thing, shockingly.
Yes, and credit where it's due. And to your point, yes. I have a job to do. I may personally really like Danielle Smith, and she knows that I do, but I have a job to do, and she knows that. The Premier's office knows that. And the job there is to hold them account for tax increases. And so they increased the fuel tax back up to 13 cents per liter, which is full strength, the provincial fuel tax here in Alberta. So we took them to task for that, and we will continue to do that. But credit also where it is due. And the MLAs at the legislature in Edmonton, so our provincial politicians, have a pay freeze. In fact, back in 2019, they took a pretty hefty pay cut. So when Premier Jason Kenney was in charge, they reduced their MLA pay by around $7,000 per year. And it's been frozen ever since. And so this time of year, with the end of fiscal, beginning of a new fiscal year, the issue of MLA and politician pay hikes comes up. And the Alberta one said no, which is really interesting. So Alberta MLAs make around $120,000 per year. And the premier of the province, no matter who's in that office, makes around $186,000 per year. Now, that's a really healthy salary. Anybody listening would be probably pretty happy to be able to be paid that kind of money. But this is really important. The premier of Alberta is paid less than the mayor of Calgary and the mayor of Edmonton. It's pretty eye-opening. And so compared to that level, that's a lower amount of pay. and it's staying there for this year. So kudos where it is due. The MLAs and the Premier are doing the right thing here in Alberta, and they've kept their pay frozen for this year.
Yeah, and it's a nice little contrast to what we've seen at the federal level, where the pay increase is basically automated and everyone just puts their hands in the air and say, well, I didn't do it. And that almost makes it worse because no one's voting on it. It just sort of happens and people end up getting this big giant pay bump without really, well, and they still have clean hands on it because they weren't personally the ones that voted for the increase.
Yes, and it's really unaccountable. And to your point, they have had 5 pay increases. Every single year, they've not missed a one. And when you think about the last timeline that we all just went through and we're still kind of emerging from, think of the lockdowns and the business shutdowns and the lost wages and the pay cuts and the pain that the average working person in Canada has been put through for the past 4 years or so, largely at the hands and actions of government. The government, federally speaking, the MPs have not missed one pay increase. Not only have they not gotten a pay cut, not only have they been shut down or suspended, they haven't missed one pay increase. So that is in stark contrast to what is happening here provincially. So again, credit where it is due. We're really happy to see this pay freeze.
So one group that does not have to suffer, in addition to federal MPs, is that of the CBC. Canada's state broadcaster gets a healthy subsidy from the taxpayer, $1.4 billion a year. We have heard from Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre that he's going to defund CBC and famously turn its Front Street headquarters into a condo so some nice suburban Toronto couple that wants to move downtown can move into Rosie Barton's makeup room as their first studio apartment. It'll be great. But one thing that I will point out here, and you did a fantastic column about this last week, and you went through the numbers, is that CBC claims whenever it's under attack that it's so important because if it didn't have a government role and a government subsidy, all of this stuff it does, no one would do. All of these non-profitable forms of programming like Indigenous coverage, Northern coverage, all of that would not happen. And you looked at the numbers here in your column, and they're not really doing that. None of their money is going towards these things that could actually be said to be part of its mandate and not really having a market alternative.
Exactly. And that's why we wanted to make that point really clear. So quite often the CBC, whenever we start saying, you know what, you guys are way too expensive and you're unaccountable and you should be defunded, they clutch their pearls, so to speak, and they say, oh, well, we're essential. You know, look at all this wonderful, magnanimous service that we provide for people. And so just to back up a little bit, when the CBC was first created, Canadians listened to it for farmers' weather reports or to get the score on the hockey game, or to get a little bit of entertainment, kind of radio soap opera entertainment that competed with the powerhouses out of places like New York City and Chicago. Like, times have drastically changed. Like, we can get that information from literally anywhere now. It's almost like finding a coffee shop on every corner street. So that has drastically changed. Further, when they try to say things like, oh, Indigenous programming, it was pretty interesting. The great reporters at Blacklock's Reporter, Holly and Tom there, they dug up this funding information, which really was eye-popping to me. They went through their financial reports, and apparently the CBC spends a little over $6 million per year on Indigenous programming. Now, again, that sounds like a lot of money, and it is. But when you compare that to how much they spent on bonuses and executive pay, like, I think the last round of bonuses, they just finished spending either $14 or $15 million on them. Like, so they're spending more on bonuses than they are on Indigenous programming. That's been labeled within their financial documents, at least. And what's also interesting here, Andrew, is that it is not just the be-all and end-all. So if you want to get something that's in Cree, for example, or other some other First Nations language or some cultural programming, the CBC is not your one-stop shop. We actually have, I really like it, we actually have a television network called the Aboriginal People's Television Network, APTN, and they do outstanding reporting. I follow them quite closely. They have a supper hour newscast. They have an investigative journalism team, and they do get some government funding, but it's a fraction, Andrew, and it's only for 2 annual events, like, you know, the First Nations annual People's Day, that sort of thing, and a festival that they hold in Winnipeg, which is where the news station is based. It's like a tiny amount compared to what the CBC gets. And yet they broadcast in all sorts of First Nations languages and they reach millions of homes every week. And so, again, we don't require the state broadcaster to provide this sort of cultural programming.
And if you were to come to me with a proposal that said, all right, we're going to get rid of all the CBC funding, but we're going to keep that $6 million, heck, maybe even increase it to $10 million. We'll keep the small budget for non-Quebec French language coverage, because let's face it, there isn't a market case for a French outlet in Edmonton, most likely. You'd be left with, again, I mean, you could still make a case that those could be done by the market under certain circumstances, but at the very least, you'd slash, even if you got rid of $1.2 billion of CBC's budget, you'd have saved a fortune and Canadians would be no worse off. And I've often said, whenever people say, well, I like the CBC, I say, great, continue to like it, continue to watch it, but pay for it yourself through advertising, through subscriptions, the way every other media company in the country is expected to operate.
Yes, exactly. And we have to keep in mind, to your point, your excellent point on language programming and what I would call kind of cultural issues and cultural programming, the CBC pot of money isn't the only taxpayer money that goes out the door for such things. Oh my goodness, not by a long shot. Anybody can take a look at the Heritage Ministry budget and see where this kind of money goes to. And so I think the Canada Council for the Arts, last time I looked, it may be higher or lower, but last time I looked, they got $500 million per year. So like $500 million. So again, the CBC funding, which is now, because they just got a pay increase, by the way, from the Trudeau government, it's now $1.4 billion. That's not the only money that is put forward for cultural programming or language programming, not by a long shot. So if folks are concerned that they won't be getting that kind of centralized niche, very specifically Canadian content that they need to have funding in their view, that they don't think has a market for it, okay, go check out a whole bunch of other departments where there's tons of money already going out the door. They could easily repurpose or properly channel some of that funding in order to meet that requirement.
Well, and also, if you watch the credits of any CBC show, like a primetime program, which, okay, there are a couple of premises there. Number one, you actually tuned in the first place. And number two, you made it all the way through to the credits. So, you
That's
know,
impressive.
Maybe you, for whatever reason, something has happened and everything else was on your TV was busted and you had to watch Little Mosque on the Prairie rerun or whatnot. You get to it, you're going to see in the credits all of these logos of various like government agencies and departments and councils that have also provided funding. So it's not just that $1.4 billion. It's all of these productions are so heavily subsidized. Now, that's true of CTV shows in Canada as well. But the entire operation is dependent on taxpayers right now.
Oh, big time. And so, again, I have to keep repeating this sometimes because what's happened with the last carbon tax fight has, again, reminded me that some folks don't know that the government doesn't have money, okay? There's no such thing as government money. They don't have money. You have money. Taxpayers have money. The government takes it from you, roughly half your paycheck, if you're a hardworking person, and they then spend it on what they want. So every time you see, if you've already made it to the end credits, if you see those little logos popping up, that's you. You have paid for this, not just through, you know, your Netflix subscription or, you know, through your cable company, or I'm showing my age by calling it that. It's not just that bill. It's your tax bill, too, that has gone to paying for this sort of entertainment and stuff. And again, think of what that money could otherwise pay for that we pay for the CBC. So at $1.4 billion, I broke it down. I think it was 6,000 new police and 6,000 new paramedics. That's how much we're paying for the CBC every single year. And again, for folks who really love it, okay, if you want. So one of their top rated shows, Andrew, I forget what it's called, but I think it's called The Great British Bake Off. Like, it's literally not even Canadian. Like, that's one of their top rated shows. If you love watching that, like, power to you. I love watching Antiques Roadshow on PBS. That's okay. But you pay for it. You choose to subscribe to that organization, or I choose to read a news outlet, for example. You can pay for it through a voluntary subscription. You don't have to force your neighbors and your family to pay for what you choose to watch.
I actually just thought Antiques Roadshow was when Peter Mansbridge was brought back on. I thought that was what that was. We do have to think of the eventualities of this. One question, even Pierre Poilievre, for all his talking about CBC defunding, has not answered this, is what happens to the poutine market?
All right.
For you, David. This is for you. No.
For me?
Hey, Liberal Party always supports CBC.
The Liberal Party always supports CBC. How many poutines can you get for $1.4 billion, Chris?
So many.
I don't know what the going rate is in the just inflation economy.
Oh, my goodness. That's a lot. Oh, my, that's a lot of poutine. And again, this highlights it. So, in defense, I don't think the journalist was expecting that.
No, David Cochran was kind of shafted there.
Yeah, and I would die. Like, if I were that journalist and these cameras are on you and this is what happens. And again, but this reminded me, remember, so I think we have the press gallery dinner coming up again soon. I've been told.
My invitation must be lost in the mail.
Right. I'm sure that they're expediting it to you. But a birdie tells me that it's happening, I think, in about 10 days or so. And so full disclosure, I have gone to one of them while I was working at CTV. All fun was had by all. But it used to be this kind of closed off in-camera roast. So it actually wasn't meant for broadcast. It was meant to have politicians elbows up with journalists and have them kind of jokingly insulting each other. I've never really found those funny because I find them cringy, but whatever. Some people really like roasts. But now it's this weird broadcasted spectacle. And that Putin thing reminded me so much of when Trudeau got up there a few years ago. And I'm paraphrasing, but he said something to the effect of, oh, well, you know, the mainstream media just says what I tell them to say. And they'd better because we paid them $600 million to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And there was like zero laughter because it was true. And
yeah, also, cut a little bit close to the bone, I think.
And also not funny. And so again, this is why we keep on banging on this drum. Journalists should not be paid by the government. It doesn't matter if you're right wing or left wing, or if you're activist or not, if you think you're an objective journalistic robot, and good for you for trying. You shouldn't be paid by the state because it is your job. One of the key jobs is to hold the truth and the powerful to account. This is the point. You're supposed to speak truth to power. And if you're getting paid by those in power, it's pretty tough to hold them to account.
No, see, I actually love the roast. I was invited to MC a leadership debate for the Conservatives in 2017. This is when they had it was like Hollywood Squares, basically. They had like a million different candidates that wouldn't all fit on the stage.
I remember that.
And I was like, but they had done all these debates. So I'm like, the only thing I could do to liven it up was just start by like just roasting them all individually for the first few minutes. And there's a boundary. You can't go over the line. You have to like go right to the line. And Chris Alexander, and I made like some barbaric cultural practices joke, which Chris Alexander thought crossed the line. Everyone else just, you know, thought it killed. So anyway, so if you need a roast master, I'm your guy. If not, I'll find someone else. But Chris Sims, we will see you on Wednesday in Ottawa at the Canada Strong and Free Conference. Always good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on today.
See you soon.
All right. Well, that does it for me for today. I'll be back tomorrow from Ottawa, so not the usual setup. And then we'll have our fantastic mobile studio for the rest of the week. We got some good guests planned for you so far, so do stay tuned. And like I said, if you are there, come out and say hello, though preferably not when I'm on air and mid-sentence, and preferably not when I have lunch in my mouth, which is always like the worst time to come up and talk to someone. I felt bad. I was at dinner with Jordan Peterson some time back, and like any time he put like a bite of food in his mouth, someone just like went over to the table and he's like, oh, nice to meet you. So try not to do that. But anyway, we will talk to you all tomorrow. Thank you. God bless. And good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.